Okay, we are in the last set of four miracles. Where have we gone so far in chapters 8 and 9? Help me out. Leprosy kicked it all off.
12.
Yes, 12 miracles. Why is that number significant?
Perfection.
Completion. I do want to make sure that we keep that distinct. Sometimes this is very easy to do, and it's just a habit you need to break. 12 does not equal perfection. Neither does 7, neither does whatever. But it does equal completion. And there's a major difference. Major difference. Okay? But that's important. The completion concept is important, especially because when we move after, hopefully tomorrow, into chapter 10, the number 12 is going to be pretty prominent in the first five verses of chapter 10. What else? Chapters 8 and 9.
Introduced to Matthew.
What's that?
We're introduced to Matthew at this point.
We are introduced to Matthew, absolutely. The first time we've seen the author of our book even be mentioned is in chapter 9, 9 through 13. And we consider that event what? A miracle. At least, or I shouldn't say we, because I'm assuming you agreed. But I consider that miracle, or consider that event a miracle. Because, you know, basically restoring him sociologically would be comparable to resurrection. What else?
Talk about the four kingdoms.
Yeah. The four kingdoms. And those four kingdoms are?
Kingdom of heaven, kingdom of Israel.
Kingdom of heaven, kingdom of Israel. Kingdom of Satan and the kingdom of Rome. Exactly. That'd be a great test question, by the way. I think we've repeated that more than once now, haven't we? The four kingdoms that converge, kingdom of heaven, kingdom of Satan, kingdom of Israel, kingdom of Rome, they're all fighting for the same territory at the same time, which produces conflict. Exactly. What else? Say it again. Yeah, that was interesting. What was significant about that, Summer?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. The oppressive regime, one of their key leaders, is said to have faith greater than anything he has found in all of Israel. Whoops. What else? Why are these miracles here? What is the purpose of going from the Sermon on the Mount into two chapters full of 12 miracles? Why is that significant? Shows his authority in what? In words and deeds. Remember, we've seen that interplay between word and deeds. We started off with the Sermon on the Mount, had four miracles. Then we go to the cost of following Jesus in chapter 8, 18 and following, and then it's followed by four miracles. Then we had, last week, we ended with the question about fasting, where Jesus makes a pretty audacious claim, basically, that fasting is not necessary right now. And the reason why is because fasting was done for four different reasons. Do we remember any of them? Three of them had to do with mourning, one of them didn't.
Mourning, personal sin.
Personal sin?
National sin.
Death. And what's the fourth reason?
Petitioning
God. Petitioning God for him to intervene in history. And Jesus says there is not a reason for us to be fasting right now. Why? Because he has been sent to take care of sins as a part of God's divine intervention. To bring life. Everything that fasting is lamenting, Jesus is offering the opposite. But he says there will be a time of mourning, but that's to come, which is the time period we're in right now. And the only reason why that makes sense, also, because then right after that he talks about the new patch on the old garment and the new, old wineskins and the new wineskins. And what was his point in that? I know we rushed through that at the very end. I want to make sure we get that right now. Does anybody remember?
It would have ripped.
Say it again.
It would have ripped.
Yeah, it would have ripped. The new garment, the new patch hole on the old garment, it would have ripped because once the garment would have been washed, it would have shrunk, pulled away, and probably created a bigger hole. What about the new old wineskins? What was the logic there that Jesus gives us in verse 18, 17? Yeah. You can't put wine, a new wine into old wineskins because it'll burst. And what does he say you need to do instead? Get a new wineskin. What is he saying about the kingdom with those two examples? The same thing. He's bringing something new. It should not be shocking the people that Him coming, bringing a kingdom that is not like anything that they have experienced before. It should not shock them. Because in order for this to progress, in order for this to move on, there needs to be something new. Now, He's already told us it's not completely new. He's not abolished the law. He's come to fulfill it. But if you fulfill something, you have altered its state, right? If you fulfill something, it is not the same as what it was before you fulfilled it. It is now progressed. It is now new. So Jesus is saying that He's bringing something new. And that word is going to need to be validated by deeds. And that's what we find with today's text, Matthew chapter 9, 18, hopefully to the end of the verse, or end of the chapter. We deal with four miracles. Two of them, well, actually both of them are grouped together. And I think they're both saying something significant. Okay? Verse 18. While He was saying this, Jesus, a ruler came and knelt before Him and said... Okay, first of all, why is this significant? Ruler. Now, do we know what type of ruler this is? Or who this ruler belongs to? Huh? You're saying no, and I'm thankful for that. This is where harmonies can help us and hurt us. This is where Life of Christ is both good and bad. Hear me very clearly. Do I think there is a place for harmonies? Absolutely. But one of the problems with harmonies is sometimes we harmonize the Scripture so much that you lose the author's distinct voice. We know from the book of Luke that this is a guy by the name of Jairus, a ruler of a synagogue. So we do know who this ruler is that has this daughter that needs to be resurrected. We do know. However, Matthew doesn't tell us. And I think it's for a reason. Because number one, Matthew would have been there, right? How do I know that? Yeah, he's already been called. He was called just like 10 verses earlier. We assume he's there, but it does say after he called him, he followed Jesus, and then he threw a party, and more than likely he was still following him. And once we get to chapter 10, he's listed in the following. So he's there. It's not like he doesn't know who this is. It's not like he would be ignorant of it, but why would he not tell us who this ruler belongs to? What does that produce? Anything? Or am I just beating on something that's absolutely pointless?
It could be a distraction.
It could be a distraction. Absolutely. If he just says ruler, what is it going to do to the audience? If I just say a ruler came, what are they going to be picturing, those that weren't there? Man of power? Yeah. And the reason why you're struggling, you have to use, I don't know who said man of power, but you have to use that vague terminology, is because they don't know. It produces ambiguity. It just says a ruler. It could be a Roman ruler. It could be a Jewish ruler. He doesn't say. Why? Because the ambiguity is his point. He purposely brings about ambiguity to say it doesn't matter which kingdom we're talking about. They all have to come, and what do they have to do? Kneel before Jesus. The word kneel there is the Greek word proskuneo. Why is that an important Greek word? Huh? Yeah, normally we translate it worship. That's interesting, eh? So the ruler comes, ambiguous ruler comes, worships, gets himself in a posture of worship before Jesus and says, my daughter has just died, but come, put your hand on her and she will live. What is significant about that? I'm going to keep asking that question a lot right now because I think it's a good question. I want you guys to think critically whenever you're looking at the text. I want to train your minds to look at the text through this lens. Why would that phrase be significant from the kingdom lens? What's that? He is definitely submitting to Jesus, isn't he? What else?
Faith.
Yes, that is the definition of faith that we've been talking about. What's the definition of faith so far? The acknowledgement and submission to Jesus' authority in both word and deed. What else? Why else is that significant? Both of those are right. What's that? Yeah. It's almost like this ruler is saying something pretty magnificent about Jesus' kingdom. Because he says, if you come and you put your hand on her, she will live. She's dead. Most people at this point have been coming to Jesus saying, you know, I'm sick with this ailment, or sociologically I'm a mess, you know, and Jesus heals them. Unbelievable. Demon-possessed, heals them. Unbelievable. Now this guy goes, I've seen your words, I've seen your power. Or I've heard your words, I've seen your power, which that'll be significant later. And he says, your kingdom, you as a king, have the ability to even bring someone back from the dead, right? Almost what we have here too is somewhat of a challenge. I don't think it's an intentional challenge, but think about what happens right here. Resurrection is not something that you normally hear about when you're looking through the annals of history, which is one of the reasons why more scientific minds say it doesn't happen at all. However, because in this moment there's somewhat of a challenge. If he comes to Jesus and he says, your kingdom can do this, right? If Jesus can't do it, it doesn't say that he's less powerful than other kingdoms, but it does say that he is not more powerful than other kingdoms. Yeah? So in this request, there is somewhat of a challenge. Jesus is on the spot, because if he can't deliver, it's not that his kingdom is worthless, it's just that his kingdom is not as powerful as everyone was hoping. Jesus got up, verse 19, and went with him, and so does his disciples. At this point, we're just assuming that that Jesus has acquiesced. Like, yeah, I can do it. I guess. He could have got up and been going, oh man, what are we going to do? It's possible. Anyway, we'll get to the end of the story in a bit. Just then, a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. What do you recognize in that verse? 12 years, let's piece all this together. Why would that be significant? 12 years. Say it again. Completion. Now, is Matthew merely reporting the amount of years? Possibly. Possibly. But I will say this, the accuracy in numbers for their historical biographers is not half as important as it is to us. We just need to accept that. Does that make sense? Sometimes we put what we want the ancient writers to be doing, writing in a scientific method that's been developed over the past 500 years, and they're just not interested in our debates and in our insecurities. They're more interested with the theological point, the main point that brings about the identity of both the one they're describing and the kingdom. 12 years. What else do you notice?
She was bleeding, so she would have been unclean.
Exactly. So that's a woman that is bleeding. More than likely, this would have been like a perpetual menstruation cycle. Perpetual.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. So this woman not only is unclean, but she's not very comfortable either. What else? Do you notice?
She touched him.
She touched him, which is a major problem. She technically touched the hem of his robe, which Jesus would have been wearing a prayer shawl, probably, as a good rabbi does, and it would have stretched to the ground. He talks about those in Matthew chapter 23 when he's rebuking the Pharisees, who make their tassels long on their prayer shawls to show everyone how wonderfully holy they are. But she touched his prayer shawl. What else do you notice?
She snuck up behind him.
Yeah, she didn't just come before him and kneel like the ruler did. She sneaks up behind him, which may be saying something about the way that she feels about herself, which also points back to this. There's one other key thing here that makes this picture complete.
She says pretty much the same thing as far as, I will be made clean.
Yes, she does do that. She has the same faith. So right now what we're doing is we're seeing a ruler who would have been ritually pure, if not even heralded as holy and righteous. He comes and he worships, and they both say similar things, where their faiths, we'll just say faith, and you know what I'm talking about. Their faiths are parallel. But what is one of the other key distinguishing things that makes them very different? She's a woman. She's a she. And this is not, because rulers in the ancient world weren't women, normally. There's a couple of exceptions, but they're extreme exceptions. Now, let's piece this together. She is perpetually bleeding in a perpetual menstruation cycle, which means she is in a perpetual state of ritual impurity. Perpetual. She is never clean. What does that mean? She's an outcast. She's an outcast of the community. What does it mean if she is a woman? Women, I hate to tell you this, but the best word to describe women in the ancient world, the way they viewed them, were parasites. Whether you're talking about resources, whether you're talking about honor, all that women could do in the ancient world was suck things out. They were the ones that drained the resources. They were the ones that hurt honor. They didn't gain honor for the community. Their job was to protect the honor from being destroyed. The only thing women could do is lose things for the community. They could not contribute anything. It's just the way it was. If a woman's husband would die, it's the reason why a lot of times she would become a beggar or even a prostitute, because there was no way for her to make any money at all. The woman in the ancient world was significant because of the potential for her to be able to bear a son. That's why if a woman was barren, she basically was considered absolutely worthless. This was a woman in a perpetual state of impurity, at least for 12 years. Why do you think he uses the word 12? He's describing the complete outcast, the complete ruin that characterizes her life. Big difference. Big difference between the status of this woman and the status of this man. And yet, they both come to Jesus with the same faith. What do I think Matthew is describing here? Why does Matthew interrupt a miracle account with another miracle account? Because I think what he's doing is this. This man is on this end of the spectrum. This woman is on this end of the spectrum. Therefore, if Jesus takes care of both in the same way, everything in between, Jesus will be able to heal. See what's happening? Okay, where are we at? She said to herself, "If I only touch his cloak, I will be healed." Jesus turned and saw her. "Take heart, daughter." Now, where have we heard that before? Have we heard that before? Where? Exactly. "Take heart, son. Your sins are forgiven," he says to the paralytic. Same word. Same word that he's going to use in chapter 14 in reference to his disciples. What do we also notice there? That same thing we noticed earlier. Take heart who? Daughter? He considers this woman a part of his family? He considered that paralytic a part of his family? And he uses the same word, take heart, that he's going to use for his disciples who are as close to him as family is, and we'll find that in chapter 12. This is insider's language here. "Take heart, daughter," he said, "your faith has healed you." And we define faith, because of these chapters, as the acknowledgement and submission of Jesus' word indeed. And the woman was healed from that moment. So he heals one end of the spectrum. Now let's see what he does to the other. When Jesus entered the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd, what is that significant for? Flute players, a noisy crowd. What? Mourning. Funeral. In the ancient world, honor and shame are the most important things. We've talked about this past week. If someone dies, the bigger the ordeal, the bigger the person was considering honor. If you make a huge deal out of someone's death, then that means that person must have been really important and honorable. It's kind of like, like when Michael Jackson died. Does that compare at all to whenever the missionaries on the fields die? To the pomp and the amazing amount of people that come out, hordes of people, hundreds and thousands of people coming out to see a guy that sang. What are we saying in our culture? We do the same things in our culture. A lot of times when people are talking about a funeral, they describe how many people were there. Because that attributes honor, significance of the person, that they have made ripple effects that were widespread. Same thing in the ancient world. In the ancient world, we even have evidence of them hiring mourners. Because women that were professional mourners that would come and weep and wail. Reason why? The bigger the ordeal, the more honor that not only does the person get that died, but by extension, the family that he leaves behind also receives. Honor was the most important thing. There are flute players here who are doing funeral dirges, and we also see the noisy crowd. The bigger the ordeal, the more honorable the person was. So the crowd would definitely be noisy and loud and crazy because this was a ruler. He said, "Go away. The girl is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand, and she got up. The word "put outside" is very important because in Matthew, that type of language is actually judgment language. Now, well, first of all, let me prove that. The fate of demons, the word "put outside," ekbalo, is used to refer to the fate of the demons in Matthew chapter 7, verse 22. Matthew 8:16, Matthew 8:31, Matthew 9:33, Matthew 9:34, Matthew 10 verse 1, 10 verse 8, 12, 24, 26, 27, 28, 17, 19. It's used consistently to describe the fate of demons. They are put outside. It's also used to describe the actions that Jesus had towards the people that were buying and selling in the temple in chapter 21, 12. They were put outside. It's also used to describe those that don't belong to the kingdom. In Matthew chapter 8, verse 12, where you're contrasting the faith of the centurion with the unfaithful. Matthew chapter 22, verse 13, the wedding banquet parable. Matthew chapter 25, verse 30, the parable of the talents. The people that are judged are put outside. Am I saying that this crowd was being judged in the same way? No. I'm not saying that. But I do. What I am saying is that that language there is significant in Matthew. Because what we have here is we have judgment language that's going to be immediately followed up by resurrection language. Because the word that Jesus used, that is used by Matthew, whenever it says he went in and took the girl by the hand and she got up, is the word agero. And the word agero is consistently used in Matthew for resurrection. You see this in Matthew chapter 14, verse 2, when Herod Antipas is worried that John the Baptist has resurrected from the dead. Same word. People that are resurrected by Jesus' power. You see this in Matthew chapter 27, verse 52. Whenever the holy people of the city of Jerusalem come out of their tombs at Jesus' resurrection, they are resurrected. Jesus used this to describe his own resurrection 4 times in Matthew. Matthew chapter 16, 21, 17, 9, 17, 23, 20, verse 19. He predicts his own resurrection using this word agero. And then it also describes his resurrection in Matthew 28, 6 and 28, 7. That he was resurrected. You see what's happening? Matthew is doing a foreshadow for us. That in the concept, the fact that Jesus comes, it brings two things. It brings judgment, but it also brings life. And it depends on if you're on the inside or the outside. But it doesn't depend on what the society says, where the society says you're at. It depends on what? What? Faith. The acknowledgement and the submission of Jesus' authority and His word and deeds. That's what it depends on. After the crowd had put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand and she got up. News of this spread throughout all the region. Now we're going to come to the last two miracles. And I think there is a significant reason why we come to these last two miracles. It is about some blind men and some, it says mute in the NIV text, but I'm going to argue that it is deaf. And I think that both of these are significant ways to end this whole section because the deeds of Jesus are things that we see. And the words of Jesus are things that we hear. And yet, even when Jesus doing the miracles, combining with the words that He's bringing, sometimes people are still deaf and blind to what He's saying and what they can see. And we'll see how that emerges. As Jesus went on from there, two blind men followed Him, calling out, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." Why is that significant? Please tell me you know that answer. What's that? What? Yeah, that's kingdom language. Son of David, have mercy on us, Son of David. When he had gone indoors, the blind men came to him and he asked them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" What's he asking them? Yeah, he's gauging their faith. "Yes, Lord," they replied. Then he touched their eyes and said, "According to your faith, will it be done to you?" And their sight was restored. Jesus warned them sternly, "See that no one knows about this." Now it's interesting because he uses the word "see" a couple of times here, but he uses it in different ways. It's defined differently in every every verse. Here, his point is that he doesn't want them to go out because of what he's done for their eyes. He doesn't want them to go out and speak. You see what's happening? What I've just done for your eyes, now that you're able to see, don't go tell someone with your words. I know that deeds are usually attached to eyesight. He says, but now that you can see, don't tell. And that's going to be flipped in just a moment. But they went out and spread the news about him all over that region. They disobeyed Jesus in a good way? I don't know. That's kind of weird. But anyway. While they were going out, a man who was demon-possessed and could not talk was brought to Jesus. Okay. The word for could not talk is ambivalent. It is the word kophos. And it means, at times, it means the man is mute. At times, it can also mean the man is deaf. How do we know which one? Context. It's kind of like asking which comes first, the chicken or the age? Chicken or the egg. Because someone that is deaf is a lot of times what? Mute. Usually, they kind of go together. And the reason why is because a lot of the ways in which we are able to function with our vocal cords is by what we hear. We hear and we mimic the vibrations in our vocal cords, which allows us to be able to speak more fluently. If you're not able to hear, a lot of times it's going to be affecting the way in which you speak. So, which is which? Context. I think here that the more accurate translation should be deaf, because I think it is contrasting those that see. And that'll become more clear. Maybe you disagree, that's fine. While they were going out, a demon-possessed man who could not hear was brought to Jesus. And when the demon was driven out, the man who had been mute spoke. The crowd was amazed and said, "Nothing like this has ever been seen in Israel." What is significant about that? He does a miracle of the ears and they say, "I've never seen this before." He does a miracle of the sight. He says, "Make sure you don't use your words." What Jesus is saying is this: I'm bringing a kingdom. And it is both with word and deed. And you know what? It's going to be put out for everyone to see and to hear. But spiritually, some will still be blind no matter what I do or say. And spiritually, some will be deaf no matter what I do and say. Regardless, the kingdom is here. Regardless, the kingdom is here. So I think that he ends with these miracles for a reason. He is, in a sense, summarizing everything we've just gone so far, from chapter 5 all the way up. He's saying, I've said some pretty amazing things, and they've seen some amazing things, but some people will still not hear and see. And that's exactly what we get in the very next verse. But the Pharisees said, it is by the prince of demons that he drives out demons. The leaders of Israel are blind and deaf when it comes to the kingdom. They just don't get it. Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in the synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness. Where have we heard this before? What? Chapter 4. Where? That's exactly right. Where in chapter 4? Flip there. Very important that we see what's happening that Matthew's doing here. Chapter 4. We've seen this exact same verse. Chapter 4, I'll give you a hint, it's higher than 20. 23. 423. Read 423 for me. Stephen.
Jesus went to Galilee, teaching in the synagogue, preaching the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and sickness among the people.
The only thing that is different there is he says all through Galilee there, and he says all throughout the towns and villages. But everything else is the same. He is teaching and preaching word. And what is he teaching and preaching? The good news of the kingdom. And he's healing every disease and sickness. Deed. You see, we had this actually precursor to Matthew 4:23 of what was going to happen in the next five chapters. But we don't realize it until now. He bookends the whole section because we're about ready to move into a brand new word section in chapter 10. The second major discourse of the Gospel of Matthew is in chapter 10. And we're kind of tightening up everything we've just gone through the last five chapters. He ends by saying that Jesus went around all the cities preaching the word, teaching the word, and healing all the sicknesses in order to both validate what? What's in the middle? What is he preaching and teaching about? Use your Sunday school answers. The preaching and teaching the good news of the kingdom. That's what the word and deeds are all about. That's how they function. And the good news, why would that word be explosive for the Romans reading this? Do we remember that story? Gospel. Yeah, it's the word for gospel. And that was what they had referred to as Augustus's birth. It was the good news in which all of creation had been made new. Whenever they even say that life, or that humans, or all creatures were given breath to breathe, that was the euangelion, because the kingdom had been established. And they're using similar language here to bring about what Jesus is doing. In verse 36, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them, because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Sheep without a shepherd comes from Numbers chapter 27, verse 17. Sheep without a shepherd comes from Numbers chapter 27, verse 17. Moses is about ready. He's on his basically last leg. He's on his deathbed. And he's worried about his people. And he's asking God, basically, well, ultimately God fills the void with Joshua, but he says this. He says, "May the Lord, the God of the spirits of all mankind, appoint a man over his community to go out and come in before them, one who will lead them out and bring them in, so the Lord's people will not be like sheep without a shepherd." And Jesus looks out over the people of Israel, and at this point in their history, he says, they look like sheep without a shepherd. They've been a mess. They've been a mess for years. And it's because their kingdom is pushing one way, but he needs it to be pushing the other. Okay, we have one more minute.
What was the verse on that?
Numbers chapter 27, verse 17. Numbers chapter 27, verse 17. I've said it four times. Just making sure that that's on the test. Numbers chapter 27, verse 17. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few." Have you seen that around campus once or twice? "Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field." Here is the irony of this. Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he tells them to pray what? To ask the Lord for what? What? Workers to go out into the harvest field. And the very next chapter is all about what? Jesus sending out the very people that are praying for those workers. There's application there. A lot of times we are praying, but we're not realizing that God wants us to be the answer to our own prayers. You know, we're praying, "Oh Lord, please help the pygmy over in New Guinea," or whatever. You know, like Papua New Guinea, I guess, would be more accurate. Or we're praying for the Muslims to come to Jesus, or we're praying for the homeless to be fed, or we're praying for. And a lot of times, Jesus is going, "Good job, harvester. Now go out into the field and reap what you pray for." Maybe you're praying for it because God's put it on your heart for a reason. It's possible, isn't it? It's just amazing how our prayers a lot of times are directed at making other people do stuff that we don't want to do. Let that one sink in for a minute. Maybe you should start listening to your own prayers and thinking, maybe this might be the direction God's taking me in my life. Because ultimately what you pray for is usually what you're passionate about, because a lot of times it's not brought to your mind unless you're passionate about it. And maybe the thing that God wants you to do for His kingdom. Think about that, pray about that. Then tomorrow we'll talk about what it means to go out. Love you guys. See you in the morning. If you have any questions about anything, let me know.